Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Here's a sample of a free podcast from the Post Wrestling Cafe. $6 gets you through the door at postwrestlingcafe.com.
There you go, everyone. That is all your news that can be found at postwrestling.com. And now we are going to shift our focus over to the G1. We have 2 days to review. And Wei, how is your G1 fatigue so far at the midway point?
Well, first of all, I want to welcome all of the free audience, because this is beyond the paywall now and not the XL edition. So welcome, everybody.
Apologies.
We are this is one of our free editions of the G1 coverage. This one featuring John and I. But of course, we've had great coverage so far from everybody in the post-wrestling G1 roster. All right. And my G1 fatigue so far has been... It's been a challenge, but not that big of a challenge, honestly, John. Like, I mean, I've kind of gotten into a nice routine where I would just try to catch up on these shows, and at 5 matches, sometimes 4 matches for one of these blocks per night, it hasn't really been that big of a challenge. I think the challenge to me has been finding interest in some of these matches, because the star power is a lot less this year. And I think the atmosphere for these shows have certainly struggled. That probably continues to be the biggest talking point coming out of this G1 so far, is the decrease in attendance.
I think that's been an overarching cloud over this G1. Like, I think, I won't say the atmosphere is dead, but it's certainly lacking. Like, you see some of these numbers, like we're about to talk about shows like 1400, 1300. Like, these are just such paltry numbers, and they are running some different venues than other ones. Quite frankly, though, like they would not be able to put crowds into an Edeon Arena sized venue. Like, I don't think it's a case of just like that. We're not just like lowering the size of some of these venues. Like, I do think this reflects the just lack of interest. And when you see comparable numbers to what Noah or Stardom are doing in regular, like similar sized buildings as well, and you know, the back-to-back nights at Oda Ward, like the first night was just a disaster. They were up somewhat the next night to around 2200, but like, we've really lowered the bar. Like, when we go through like the final attendance figures for this year's G1, I think it's going to reflect that. On the other side, not to be all like doom and gloom, I do think some of the performers, like, there have been several that have stepped up in a big way. They've been hampered by the Gabe Kidd injury. There is the House of Torture stuff, but I don't know what it is, but like, I feel like I'm less down on a lot of the House of Torture stuff, maybe because it's just expected, but you are seeing it between Evil, Ren Narita, Sonata, so I should be maybe more bothered by it. But to me, Tanahashi has been a pleasant surprise in this G1. Like, I've enjoyed like watching this man struggle to just get to the next match. And it's like watching this guy who's got so little left, but he's mortgaging it all to get through this tournament. And I found it compelling. I'm not finding it sad watching these matches with Tanahashi. So I think overall he's overperformed where my expectation was set going into, you know, 9 singles matches that he had to put out, and we're halfway through, and I would say he gets a passing grade for sure.
Well, they announced that Tanahashi would be doing the G1 this year, you know, after skipping out last year, now in a body in even worse state than it was probably a year ago. I think we all had our expectations very low, and he's greatly exceeded those very lowered expectations. And as we'll talk about in the main event of the shows we're about to cover, he's essentially like this old car that is on its last, like, really, really last few miles, and he is driving the shit out of it. He's trying to get everything that he can out of this body, and even if his speed is not where it was, even if the high fly flows aren't as high as they used to, the effort and the will are still there, and it's still very evident, and it's making his matches very compelling to watch. Yeah, like you said, John, it's like this has been a G1 that's really suffered from a lack of star power, and the exit of a Tetsuya Naito, now the exit of a Gabe Kidd, the exit of a Hiroki Goto. This G1 has just been like suffering in ravaged terms of just, yeah, a lot. But it continues to open the door for a lot of people to fill those voids, and it's going to suffer in terms of attendance in the short term. But coming out of this, I do think there's a lot of potential for various people to get the certain types of spotlights that they wouldn't have had otherwise. And I would include in that Taichi, who was not even supposed to be in this G1, but because of the Goto injury found his way in and has now kind of adopted that sort of like veterans, like sentimental favorite underdog type of role. And he's been doing a great job delivering. I think on the come up, Drilla Maloney has been, I think, one of the standouts to me as far as like, you know, gaijin wrestlers go. He's somebody who like making the sort of jump up to heavyweight has really impressed me in terms of just his look, you know, the guy looks amazing. He's got an incredible like physique, and in terms of just his ability to get that Drilla Killer over, he's definitely, I think, making an impression on me.
Yeah, Taichi as the Dante Hicks of this year's G1 from Clerks.
Oh, I wasn't even supposed to be here today.
Yes, that has been one of the pleasant stories of the G1 so far. Yeah. I would say of some of like the rising talent, to me, like Ryohei Oiwa has been someone that's I think like stood out in this tournament as well. Like Uemura and Umino seem to be getting more of a spotlight, but it's Oiwa that I think has really capitalized in a lot of his big matches. And I'd also say that a guy I really enjoy this unconventional style of Oleg Bolton, that I find him really compelling to watch. He's not smooth, but that's not a negative. Like, he's just this powerhouse with this raw strength that he's made tons of improvements over the years. And I just find a lot of his matches to be like, I'm really engaged in watching Bolton. Like, he's not going to be everyone's performer of the tournament, but I generally get up for a lot of his matches as well. So those are some of the positives. Also, flying under the radar, maybe, you've spoken about Drilla Maloney on commentary, and maybe he's been the best wrestler turned commentator that we're hearing, but by far the funniest is El Fantasmo, who is somebody that is pretty much the closest you could have to WH Park being hired to do New Japan World commentary, where on last Sunday's show, some of the highlights included El Fantasmo openly stating to Walker Stewart, "I can't even tell you who the Never Six-Man Champions are." And Walker just says, "Well, maybe you should watch the product." And he just continues all show long. He complained about having to watch the footage on their monitor in 480p and can barely make out the footage. He brought up when Tanahashi was first named president and listed 10 rules, some of which were limiting run-ins and interference and wishing that they would be enforced. And I had totally forgotten about these rules Tanahashi had put out. And then when Walker casually mentions Tetsuya Naito, there's a pause and Fantasmo responds, "I wonder what he's up to." This guy is, I find him hilarious. I won't say he's the most effective at getting the product over, but goddamn am I entertained by this guy, because he just says anything that comes to mind. And it's, if you want a non-filter on New Japan commentary, El Fantasmo's your guy.
Or at the very least a podcast afterwards or something.
I can't even tell you who the Never Champions are.
Yeah, I guess continuing to show that English commentary in New Japan is really just an island unto itself.
It's, dude, just flip it on and you are your own producer. That's how the English broadcast works. So let's get into day number 8. This was on Wednesday, where they were in Osaka, but not at the famous Ideon Arena, but rather Yamato Arena. Attendance 1,390. And this show was going to feature Gabe Kidd taking on Yoshihashi, but of course the forfeit provides Yoshihashi his latest 2 points. So now he's a contender way.
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, because of the forfeits, the math is, I think, a little bit more challenging to just figure out at this point. But we're also still kind of early, so that we're not even really doing that much G1 math yet.
Yeah. Quickly just going through the results of the undercard, Yota Tsuji and Daiki Nagai beating Taichi and Masatoru Yasuda. Yasuda, who's getting involved in all of these matches, they're letting him like stand up for his pairings and such. Yuya Uemura and Shoma Kato over Tanahashi and Katsuya Murashima. Sanada and Yoshinobu Kanemaru over Callum Newman and Jacob Austin Young. Ryohei Oiwa and Hartley Jackson beating Evil and Dick Togo. And Oleg Bolton and Toro Yano beating Ghetto and David Finlay. So those were your five undercard matches, taking us into tournament action, where we are kicking off with the voice of New Japan World, El Phantasmo, with 2 points, taking on the Great Okan, who enters this with a 2-2 record and 4 points.
And so, you are doing the points without the Gabe Kid.
Yeah, I had just copied their records from up until this point, but I guess yeah, you could tack on.
He has 2 wins at least, according to NJPW 1972. I don't know where you're.
Okay, let's just go through the point totals at the end.
Okay,
we will get everyone up to speed. Kid has really screwed up my records.
Yeah,
you wouldn't believe what they did. They fought into the crowd. Way, I think everyone's like mandated to do this at least once per match.
Phantasmo has been doing it a lot too in his matches. I mean, you certainly expect it out of House of Torture, but like in the Phantasmo matches, you're getting that a lot. And I don't know. Maybe it's more evident when he's doing like his spots, but I always think it's somewhat unfortunate because you get a great glimpse of how empty these buildings are whenever he's doing these sort of.
Well, after hearing this guy on commentary, I'm wondering if he's specifically targeting the empty bleachers on purpose, because it just looked like a ghost town here in Osaka. They make their way back and Okan would work on the lower back and gets the Cobra Twist with the claw applied. Phantasmo would land on his feet from a German, pops up from another, and hits the unidentified flying opponent. But in doing so, hurts the back, stops an eliminator, and connects with the sudden death super kick, and goes, Okan goes for the Tenzan Tombstone Driver, the TTD. How many people are borrowing from Tenzan at this point? Like, this is the guy that from Tony Storm to CM Punk to Great Okan, I mean, everyone is borrowing from Tenzan these days.
Yeah, we got like a Tenzan, backdrop later on.
Yes, that's
Mongolian
right.
Chops all over the place. Yeah, very influential wrestler, clearly.
So he goes for the TTD off the turnbuckle, but it stopped, and Phantasmo climbs and ends up getting hit by a super eliminator as Okan pins him in 14 minutes and 50 seconds. Okan picking up 2 more points in a. What I would, your thoughts first on the match.
I thought it was a good match with some really strong comebacks from ELP. You know, crowd loves him as a babyface. I'll say maybe continues to feel like a mid-level mainstay without, unfortunately, a whole lot of upward momentum for like an upper card spot that I think a lot of others are probably ahead of him for. I continue to find Okan, in my opinion, kind of unconvincing as a serious wrestler. I just think for me, the gimmick and wrestling style are just a little too comedic rather than dominant. But I overall thought the action was good. Wouldn't say it was a match that left a lasting impression, but I think a lot of that is the atmosphere affecting a lot of these matches as well.
Yeah, I would say this was on kind of the... this wasn't Okan's best match I've seen in the G1, but I thought it was like a very good match, but not getting to the great level. And what do I mean by that? It means that I am going large with a splash of milk, but there was no sugar in this. It did not have the sweet factor in all of this.
I also go large, okay? And I guess just to catch everybody up, this is our particular rating system. Now, everybody who's a host here in these G1 reviews has their own specific rating system. Listen, John and I started doing these. We needed a ratings, okay? And because of the cafe theme, all right, coffee, fine. These other hosts, they've taken it and they've just taken our very systematic, sort of like prestigious coffee rating system. And they've just gone nuts, all right?
So now they bastardize our prestigious coffee rankings.
So, like, I mean, Karen's got ice cream scoops. Okay, that makes sense. Bruce Lord is just, like, all of a sudden, like, he's just got, like, all sorts of, like, different whiskeys that none of us have ever heard of. And so when he rates a match like a fucking Glenfiddich, like something, I have no idea what it is. But if you he knows what it is, okay?
Get some Port Ellen.
Port Ellen, yeah. WH Park like changes it every year. And this year he's got, what does he have? He's rating it according to his favorite ramens. So like a shoyu ramen is like the, you know, the very bottom. And then like, I think a tonkatsu ramen is a very, it only makes sense if you're paying attention. Okay. And, it is part of the appeal. But I've kind of wanted to simplify mine, John.
Oh, that's not the fun part of this.
I guess when I say simplify, I mean, I wanted to make a more akin to an actual order you would give at Tim Hortons. And those of you who are Canadian, who know Tim Hortons, it's got a certain lingo, and you can ask for, you're obviously a coffee size, but to denote how much coffee, cream or sugar you want into it, you can ask for a regular, which is one cream, one sugar. In your case, John, one milk, one sugar. You can ask for a double-double, which is two creams, two sugars. You can ask for a triple-triple, which is three creams, three sugars.
Actually, that's the scientific term is gross.
Well, you must have not heard of some of these others, because you can also ask for a 4x4, which is four creams and four sugars.
Yeah.
And if you're feeling very daring, John, you can go to Tim Hortons and you could say, give me a Wayne Gretzky. You know what that is?
A turncoat?
What number does Wayne Gretzky wear?
No, you can't.
Nine sugars. No, okay.
Dude, like, why don't you just like rip open your shirt and start palpitations? Like, you're a horrendous person. If you're
once
a
in
Wayne
your life,
Gretzky,
you can afford one to try one Wayne Gretzky at one point in your life.
No, my heart cannot afford that. That is a level of disgust. Like, why even the coffee? Like, just give me packets of sugar to just down.
It's essentially just like sugary milk is what you're drinking.
That sounds like I'm trying not to vomit right here on my desk.
It is a thing. Now, I don't know if I'll rate any of the matches.
Have you ever been in person for someone to order such a thing?
No. It's a stunt thing. I have seen people order like triple triples. Okay.
I've heard some crazy ones. Yeah, like multi, like even higher than that, but never this Wayne. This is the first I've heard of this Wayne Gretzky bit.
Well, maybe you and I at some point.
All that is to say, is there such a thing as a Wayne Gretzky match?
Of course there is. Of course there is.
Maybe if El Fantasmo declared allegiance to the Republican Party and would not stand up for Canada potentially being annexed, that would be a Wayne Gretzky.
See, I'm not really up on my Wayne Gretzky politics. I'm mainly talking about the number. Nonetheless, this one for me gets a large and simply black. All right. No cream, no sugar.
Love black coffee. That's a great rating. Okay. Well, we're going to be here about 3 hours by this point. We go next to Drilla Maloney and Ren Narita. And Kanemaru attacks Drilla on his way to the ring. So Narita holds referee Marty Asami at bay as Narita is hit, uses a chair in the follow-up. And Kanemaru is constantly getting involved. Maloney catches a low blow attempt, and Kanemaru executes a trip from the floor and a chair shot from behind, leading to a schoolboy and Drilla kicking out and having to fight the numbers. He blocks a double cross. Drilla gets shoved towards Asami, stops, gets low blowed, and then the double cross is hit. So Narita comes off the top and is caught into a sit-out powerbomb for a big near fall. There's yet another ref bump as Kanemaru enters with the whiskey bottle, is taken out with the gore, and Maloney lands his own low blow, gore, and Drilla killer to win in 9 minutes and 56 seconds as Drilla Maloney and Ren Narita provide a medium coffee with a milk, but unfortunately, they got the name wrong, so you had been waiting and waiting for your order, and it's been there. So when you finally leave the Tim Hortons, you're walking to your car and you take a sip, it's lukewarm.
Oh, I hate it when that happens. That has happened to me, where like they either messed up my name or they thought somebody didn't pick up, and then it turned out it was my order. Anyway, we're going to be talking a lot about House of Torture matches, and the fact
there's about 18 more to come.
Yeah, and they're all kind of essentially are a bit similar in that they offer a lot of cheating, and it's just continues to be one of the more debated aspects of modern day New Japan is just all the cheating that's there for a company that's supposed to pride itself as being king of sport, right? I'm a lot more maybe open to it than I think most are. For me, when I see a House of Torture match, when I watch this sort of cheating, I ask whether or not it was engaging, whether or not it provided some sort of value in elevating the match and elevating the babyface, especially. And this was a case where I thought it did. You know, I also look for any sort of creativity that might be in the cheating itself. And I thought, despite how small this crowd sounded, they eventually arrived at a big spirited feeling in the conclusion, mainly due to Maloney's very good babyface performance. But I also think, you know, it was the spotlight that was created for him via the House of Torture tactics that allowed him to do that. They gave us a bit of a blade job. Wasn't much of a blade job, but it was a bit of a rare, you know, New Japan.
Yeah, that's right. Drilla. Well. Yeah. Drilla needed to do a bit more drilling.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was still successful in again, building heat for the Maloney comeback. And I thought Maloney looked great, you know, so he to me has star potential, and I think that's due to the look, that's due to also the way he composes himself in ring. So I was engaged. I went large, double.
Wow. Well, we are at odds on that one. Do you see star power in Ren Narita?
No. Not in this incarnation. I mean, it's hard for anybody in House of Torture to really feel that way.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
Shota Umino against Shingo Takagi followed, and Umino very early prevents a Made in Japan, but lands the dragon screw into the corner and starts working on the knee. They're trading exploders. Lots of suplexes are thrown, and Takagi is selling the knee, limping all over the place, and executes a superplex, hits Made in Japan, but Umino stays alive. He battles to his feet, landing a tornado DDT, and it's Umino showing some fire, which is still an element of his game that I think is it's still in development, the big fire-up spot. But he did look good here. Goes for the second chapter and is countered with a brainbuster. Umino kicks out at one. Last of the dragon, but it is hit. But Takagi's right knee is so injured, he cannot manage to make the cover. And he gets to his feet, as does Umino, connects with the pumping bomber, and we get a close-up of Umino's eyes. This was the turning point in the man's career, okay? These eyes are rolling into the back of his head. The crowd is heated. This was the turning point. This was Umino's Austin 316 moment, this eye roll. And he is hit with the burning dragon as Takagi wins in 22 minutes and 45 seconds in a spectacular match.
This was a great match. Again, like struggling with a smaller, less lively crowd, but by the end, I thought they extracted about as much as they could from them. And that's a credit to them both. But to me, mainly Shingo Takagi, who worked really hard to engage and pump up this crowd.
He's been like the glue, I feel, of this tournament. Everyone takes this guy for granted. He's like the most consistent guy you've got in a tournament like this. He has not had one bad performance in this G1 and probably won't have anything close to just average the rest of this tournament. But he's not going to be the Takeshita that gets all the spotlight or others, for instance. But man, is this guy just, you can bank on this guy. And he's been great in this tournament.
You look at the entire G1 field. I think it's Takeshita who might be considered the best in the world right now. But I think Shingo is right up there with him. And at least as a New Japan mainstay, you could still make the argument that he might be the best, you know, bell to bell. Great selling of the knee injury, great intensity in all of his offense. But I thought Shota was also really good here.
This was not a one-man performance.
Yeah, I thought his intensity was great from the beginning. I think his facial expressions continue to be one of his strengths. I loved seeing him lead more towards being a heel here, playing the aggressor and putting Shingo in the back pedal. It feels like a far more natural role to me for Shota Umino. And I think, to me, it's a good indicator that whenever they do actually decide on a heel turn, I feel like it would be the crowd would take to it. And you know, it makes me wonder how much of the criticism of him is simply maybe down to him being placed in an inappropriate role, you know, along with, I think, some very bad choices for his hair. And
the scooter was a big that took a lot of the oomph out of Shota Umino. But this was an XL with an espresso shot.
Do you do espresso shots in your coffee?
Extremely rare that I do. It's been a while since I've had one, but I never have felt I've gotten, it makes no difference to me the few times I have. Yeah,
maybe for me it's mainly mental as well, but I've started doing them and mainly for the flavor, actually. Like for people who hate Tim Hortons or maybe just think it's watery coffee, to me, if you want to
do you
more
get it with
flavor,
like the cream and sugar on top of it, or do you just
I do.
What's the order? You just add espresso on top of it.
Well, I'll do a regular with an espresso shot. Gotcha. If I really need a hit. But yeah, I'm no snob, I guess, when it comes to that sort of thing. I went XL double double for this one.
Yeah. This was a great match. And, you know, on these four match shows, it kind of feels as though, you know, the benefit is that some of the bigger matches, you get back-to-back matches here to close out the show that got plenty of time. And we go into the main event, probably one of the matches people had circled for the whole tournament, Zack Sabre Jr. and Konosuke Takeshita first time ever match between these two in a singles capacity. And they talk about the fact Takeshita has the toughest schedule in the block because he had a match with Gabe Kidd. I mean, I don't know if this is exactly the Iron Man, but I'm not going to dispute the fact that this guy has probably been the consensus leader of the match quality at the midway point. But Zach is not too far off. Zach suffered some losses early. He's introduced this new choke that I'm enjoying as kind of a new submission finisher for him on top of his laundry list of other alternatives. So Zach is wrapping up the legs of Takeshita, manipulating the fingers, and then snaps them. He isolates the arm, and they are sent out of the ring. He goes for a flying guillotine on the floor. Takeshita just lifts him up for a brain buster onto the floor and hits the bastard driver into the wheelbarrow, and as he sets up for the power drive knee, is caught in a heel hook, which took me back to our open mat days when I would try my power drive knee on Wei Ting, and he always had that heel hook.
I never learned heel hooks, actually. But,
no?
No. Would be fun.
They do these amazing counters out of the European clutch. It's like their transitions were phenomenal here, and the crowd is just kind of in awe of just the smoothness here. They continue these roll-ups, finally ending with the power drive knee that it felt like this big accomplishment when Takeshita finally landed it. Goes for the blue thunderbomb that somehow my autocorrect changed it to the blunder thunderbomb, which sounds like a great name for a messed up blue thunderbomb.
Thunderbomb. That's even cooler. Mm-hmm.
It's followed by a Zach driver, and Takeshita gets up, winds up, and is met with the slap from Zach, who runs full force into a knee strike. This was your Nakamura Sakuraba spot from Wrestle Kingdom 2013. Great spot. And just this empty stare on the face of Zach after eating Takeshita's knee. Raging Fire turned into a rear naked choke, and Takeshita climbs the turnbuckle to try and break free. Zach is on him like glue and elevates Zach onto his shoulders and just awkwardly sends him off. And Zach stays on the back, getting to this rear naked choke that he's been using, and puts Takeshita out in a 22-38.
Yeah, towards the end, I don't exactly know, like, what maybe Takeshita was going for with the electric chair.
I rewatched this several times, and I could not figure out what the intended goal was.
Yeah, it might have, to me, like, it's the type of thing that I feel probably wasn't didn't appear as they intended.
I think
that,
you wanted like a slick counter to the rear naked choke and not this like struggle
especially for the finish, right? Yes, you know, I think they were probably, maybe something was messed up there, but that was like the only blemish, I would say, of an otherwise amazing match. Takeshita is from Osaka here, so this was like a hometown crowd for him. So they did a bit of a role reversal here.
Immediate family only, though, that attended.
Yeah. Well, maybe they were too busy.
Too harsh.
They didn't even show up. But, like, Takeshita coming in here, coupled with, I think, how likable he is anyway, we got a bit of a role reversal in Takeshita being a babyface, Zach playing largely, again, heel aggressor. And I thought Zach was great as the heel because he's just, to me, his role is most fitting as this sort of aggressive dickhead. And he's got this sort of submission quicksand style that I think ultimately works better as an obstacle for a more explosive wrestler to try to overcome. And Takeshita is that type of wrestler. Like, Takeshita works as a heel because he's so large and convincingly dominant. But within that is just a great wrestler with incredible fighting spirit that you know was exemplified in a match like this. And it probably his long-term value is most likely as a babyface, whether it be in AEW or maybe in New Japan. But I thought both were excellent, and this made me want to see a more full-on heel Zack Sabre championship run coming out of this. And I thought there were some amazing pinning reversal sequences here, some very stiff strikes. I overall really like that rear naked choke sequence, especially when Takeshita climbed up to the top to try to break it, only for Zach to continue to hold on tighter. I thought this was, to me, among the very best of the G1 so far. I went XL, triple, triple.
Wow, man, he shoots, he scores, number 99. This was excellent. I went XL, throw in my sleeve, throw in some sugar and a dash of milk as well. I thought, honestly, like the last two matches were fairly comparable. Like I would highly recommend both of these matches off this card, but this one might get the edge because afterward it did allow for one of the shows I'm reviewing to give us a Zack Sabre Jr. promo and my one time of the year. Takeshita, you may be the alpha, but I'm fucking heavyweight champion, dickhead.
Thank you.
Perfect. Did you think that Zach was here intercepting our review?
I had no idea.
It sounded identical to him.
Did you load up a clip in the soundboard?
Imagine Mark Shapiro doing Zach. That would be a...
That car ride. Oh, I'm sure a discussion on politics would be very interesting.
Maybe Mark Shapiro joins Cameo. That could be fun. Is Cameo still a thing?
I'm not sure.
Great final two matches. Those are my recommended matches. Way, I don't know if you, I think you have a little bit of love for the Ren Narita match, but I'm not going to put that on my
recommend. Not enough to recommend. Yeah, I agree. It's the final two.
So where are we at the, let's do the standings after this, this next show. We'll do the full update. So we fast forward to today's show, and this is their first of three consecutive nights of G1 with Saturday and Sunday to follow, and your next G1 show dropping on Sunday. So down to 12:44 in Kagawa, and the undercard featuring Shota Umino and Katsuya Murashima over Yoshihashi and Shomakato, Drilla Maloney and Taiji Ishimori beating Konosuke Takeshita and Rocky Romero, El Fantasmo teaming with Jado over Shingo Takagi and Daiki Nagai, and Zack Sabre Jr. with Hartley Jackson prevailing over Great O'Conn and Jacob Austin Young. So back to five tournament matches, starting off with Sonata and Callum Newman. And where did the Sonata sequined suit with splotches of hair dye rank among the Sonata appearances?
Well, we should maybe wait for Eric Marcotte's breakdown of that for his sonata scale. This one I don't think was as offensive as maybe, or even as memorable as maybe some of the other ones. John Gonzalez suit being the most offensive. Next to that, maybe the fishnets, and then the speakers, and then maybe this one below that.
Well, guest commentator Drilla Maloney called it, quote, disgusting. I don't know if I go that far. I've seen some disgusting outfits from Sonata. I don't know if this qualified, but it was his opinion. How did you spoke highly of Drilla Maloney in past reviews. What did you think about Drilla Maloney? I would say three quarters of the way through the show, because I feel this guy's voice was like dead by the main event, and he was very Walker Stewart heavy, and you could sense Drilla getting a little drilled in the esophagus.
Right. Yeah. This was a show where I felt Walker Stewart shined a bit brighter. I think he's been great. You know, as this sort of a voice of New Japan, sounds very professional, knows his shit, and yeah. Otherwise, I think just does a great job.
What are your, like, when you tune in and the guest commentator speaks, like, who are the ones that you get that are more highly anticipated versus ones that are like, okay, this guy.
I think Rocky continues to be, to me, like a high standard for that voice. Like, he's able to find the balance between staying in character while still providing like good analysis, even now as a heel. I think he does a good
Charlton
job.
And Rocky are my top ones that I enjoy listening to the most. Phantasmo I'm entertained by, but he's probably more polarizing among some. He reminds me a bit sometimes of like Steve Corino at times when he was in New Japan.
Hmm. I think they mostly like find good picks, you know, to audition.
Yeah. All right. So Sonata begins the match. We get a big somersault dive by Newman, and they fight into the audience. And Newman sets up for an Irish whip, and as he comes off the ropes, snaps his neck under the top rope. And I thought that this guy was this looked very concerning, and he seemed rattled by this as well. I always go back to that Enzo spot where, you know, he suffered the injury on WWE pay-per-view here. I mean, this just, his head just got caught under. Like, the odds of this happening are probably very low. But continued the match, seemed okay, but this was, could have been, like, you don't appreciate, like, how much of a potential injury this could cause.
Oh, I hurt myself, like, just walking. Yeah, I could appreciate it.
Sonata would go after his left knee, and then Newman manages the Os Cutter, but Kenta Sato is used as a shield, and we got a drive-by Os Cutter. Hate when this happens.
Yes.
So out goes Sato. Deadfall gets blocked, and again, Newman is attempted to be sent into Sato. Low blow gets prevented by Newman, who hits a knee strike out of the corner and his Prince's Curse to pin Sonata in 10 minutes and 11 seconds, and we are going a solid medium with a milk here. I don't think I will ever think of this match again after this review.
I'm very much the same, medium regular for me. A pretty forgettable match. I think Newman has impressed me in his recent matches, like not just with his high flying, but his selling. Didn't really get to showcase anything notable, I would say, in this particular match. It had the usual House of Torture shenanigans, but there's even nothing creative at all or like, I think, I don't know, exciting about it for the audience. So a bit below average, actually.
Yeah, like forgettable match, to say the least. Ryohei Oiwa and Evil. We have Oiwa, who is rammed into the guardrail, and they knock over this poor timekeeper, who's probably going to be in traction by the end of this G1.
Oh, he loves this. Like, you could tell this, Abe, right? He lives for this, like... He's so into it, and just like
he might die for this too. I mean, these are serious bumps this guy takes. Walker refers to the House of Torture as Jamokes, and this is obviously a new term that Drilla Maloney had never heard before. So expanding his vocabulary.
I've never heard of it.
You've never heard of Jamokes?
Jamokes, no. What's the origin? Is it?
I think I first heard it on The Sopranos, but it was it's just
interesting.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay. Start using it.
Well. Jamoke. Something I've also never heard. Oiwa hits a senton as Hartley Jackson says, quote, a little something out of Hartley Jackson's book. Which I don't know if anyone has ever cited before. The inspiration behind something is Hartley Jackson offering this.
I mean, I get since they're stablemates, maybe that's the connection.
I guess so. Evil gets sent into the exposed buckle, and Dick Togo gets crotched on the top, and Hartley Jackson, the man, the myth himself, appears to fight off Fale, which that to me is that's Tokyo Dome level. You don't give away Hartley Jackson and bad luck.
Hey,
Fale.
Man, we could have been talking about Fale in the G1.
Could you have imagined? I think yeah. We would have tapped out by now. Evil's head gets rammed into the exposed buckle over and over, and then Oiwa hits what is, anyone can watch, Javon Evans getting that incredible height off his Aus Cutter in NXT or these impressive frog splashes. Oiwa's belly flop splash is currently my favorite. This is a guy that gets almost no height, but it just looks so impressive. It's kind of like Bronson Reed, who the appeal is just the man gets up and he just free falls onto the target. That, I don't know. Those are the splashes off the top. I don't want to see a guy performing a gymnastics routine. I want to see a big man land belly first onto the target and squeeze the life out of them.
When you have weight, you don't need to do flips. You don't need to be so fancy with it. A straight drop onto somebody is enough of an impactful, awe-inspiring spot.
So he hits the splash of death and then a chaos theory, but Evil manages to duck the grip. And then from the floor, powder is thrown into the face of Oiwa. Marty Asami, who has been distracted, turns around, just a sea of powder throughout the air. Where did this come from? Did this come out of the vents? I don't understand. And the Darkness Scorpion is applied onto Oiwa, who is forced to tap at 9:27. This match was going along swimmingly, and then we had this Jamoke filled finishing sequence that took it down a couple notches for me, I will say. But I've enjoyed Oiwa overall in this tournament, and Evil less so.
Yeah, I mean, again, when it comes to the House of Torture, I feel like you just kind of expect this stuff, right? And
way went high on this one.
Well, I am setting it up, right? Because it's down to whether or not it elevated the overall match and elevated the babyface's performance. And I felt like my focus entirely in this match was on Oiwa, and I thought it provided a great chance for him to show his fire and made him, by the end, despite the loss, look like a very compelling babyface trying to overcome the 3-on-1 advantage. So
not a jamoke?
No, not at all. I mean, he did lose, but I still thought he looked good here in what is essentially still a developmental type of setting for a guy like him. So, I mean, you felt the constant pressure of the House of Torture cheating, and you felt the desire to want to see Oiwa try to overcome it. So I went large, John.
I went medium with a milk. That's where I was with a dash of powder on top. Where they write your order on top of it with that annoying powder marker. That got into
the
coffee.
Chalk?
Yes, that's exactly it. It slipped into my coffee and I could taste it. So it was a nice coffee otherwise, but this thing just poisoned it.
Chalk and coffee. That would be unpleasant. Torture even.
It was the House of Tim.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chopped-tees.com/post-wrestling.
Oleg Bolton against David Finlay. Finlay in desperate need of a win. He only has one heading into this, and they do clarify he is not facing elimination yet. So this top three qualifying has given plenty of leeway to rack up losses here. Of course, we have our guardrail spot. I think that's mandated. Into Oblivion connects on Bolton, who kicks out, and it's Finlay with the short arm clotheslines, but then runs into a kamikaze and kicks out. Bolton would fight back, dragging Finlay off of the rope into a released German, goes for another kamikaze, and Finlay counters, hitting the he goes for the kamikaze, but then he turns it into the verdict onto Finley. And then as he goes for one final kamikaze, it's countered into a cradle by Finley in 10 minutes and 52 seconds. I wouldn't say this got to like the next gear. It was, they were kind of getting it going, and it was more so the story of Finley kind of using his veteran presence to outsmart the power man at the end of this. The power man, and Finley gets his second win of the tournament.
Mm-hmm. It told like a good brains versus brawn type of story, you know. Good showcase for Bolton Oleg, who I thought successfully conveyed this sort of like aura of like a brute, like a Hulk.
That is kind of the character, a brute.
Yeah, he's like the Hulk, you know. He'll just like scream and lift you. I thought he was a lot of fun to watch. Meanwhile, I think Finley, being a bit more methodical in trying to tame the beast, did a good job here. I don't know if like I was so enthralled by just like the chemistry between the two in that I didn't, there wasn't to me somebody I clearly wanted to win or clearly wanted to lose, but the action was decent. I don't know, large for this one as well.
I went, what did I go on this one? Yeah, I went medium, medium with a milk and sugar on this one. Like a good match for what it was. Not, maybe suffering a little from the G1 fog, but also not a match that's like if I bring this match up to you Monday night after we finish Raw and I ask you to cite anything from this match, will you have
I
any
will forget
memory?
This match sometime in the next hour.
That's impressive. Taichi Yotasugi, second from the top. The pants of Taichi come off 6 minutes in. It really is his rainmaker spot. Like, you know, the match is not officially underway till the pants come off. Dodges the Marlowe crash and then is hit with a Liger Bomb by Tsuji for the two count, and we get a short-range Gene Blaster, several of these in the match. He hits the curb stomp, goes for another Gene Blaster, and is met with a forearm smash from Taichi right into the dangerous backdrop suplex. And this audience, they just all get behind Taichi. Like, he really has been somewhat of like a sentimental favorite in this tournament, and the guy is working his ass off in these G1 matches. He lifts Tsuji by the wrist after the dangerous backdrop and is caught with another short-range Gene Blaster. Both men are down, so the crowd is chanting them on. This is where Maloney, I think, had lost his voice, because he's just like barely present here, and the last we heard of him, it was sounding a little rough. Marlowe crash is met with a super kick by Taichi, another dangerous backdrop for the near fall, and Walker Stewart yelling, "Holy God! Holy God!" And then the Black Mephisto at 15:58, which I think should be renamed the Holy God. I mean, that to me is a...
Ooh, I love
that's,
it.
That's a name. Great match here. I think that they got into XL territory here with a sugar, a little added sweetness here. And Taichi continues to be, he's been very, very consistent in this G1.
Yeah. He's makes me wonder, like, what his summer plans were if he wasn't going to do the G1. Like, if Goto was healthy, like, did he have just vacation plan?
Lip sync karaoke gone.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he's had to instead put his working boots on. But
maybe he's going to work at Kawada's ramen restaurant.
That would be quite the summer
from
drop.
The master. Yes.
Yeah. I thought they were both awesome here, and Taichi played this great underdog, showing a ton of exhaustion and will to fight through. And I think to me most notable about this match is the crowd favoring Taichi over Yotasugi. And, you know, like, it shows to me that the crowd is probably still a lot more willing to hang on to this, like, current generation of guys than to just see them, like, be put aside to make way for, you know, like, a Yotasugi or, like, any of the Reiwa 4.
I'm just saying, like, I don't necessarily disagree, but that's, you know, I understand, like, there's an attachment to the stars of yesterday, but I would be concerned about overall, like, if they're not having that same affinity for any of these guys, that they don't view them at this level, and that is a bit of a struggle. It's like you're replacing this generation of, like, even a Taichi level, who was never a main guy, but that's what New Japan is trying to do, and I think it has been a struggle to elevate this class overall that is going to have to replace all these names.
Well, look at who the biggest star that they've created this year is. It's Goto. dude. Mm-hmm. Like, he's the guy that this audience wants to see crowned. Yeah. And there are, like, I would suggest maybe a number of Gotos out there, maybe Taichi being one of them.
Where, yeah, Taichi is pretty much Goto in this tournament.
Yeah, where, like, you know, there's a lot of conversation about who's going to become, like, you know, the next ace of the promotion. Meanwhile, you have a lot of guys who day in and day out work their asses off that have yet to receive similar pushes that are being overlooked. Yeah. And the idea of somebody getting overlooked for a promotion when they've been there for years in favor of a young guy straight out of grad school or something like that, that's a far more relatable babyface character than whatever, like, a Shota Umino or even like a Yotsuji represents.
Yeah.
So maybe the continued key to New Japan's success, at least in the next few years, is not necessarily in creating new stars, but to continue elevating these existing sort of like tenured mid-card guys like a Taichi. So they are building something here with Taichi. So I wonder how far they'll go with it. XL regular for this one.
Yeah, I do like the story of the New Japan aces versus the ageists.
The aces and the ageists. Can we call the Millionaires Club and the New Blood?
Who would be the baby faces? Because WCW didn't have a really good handle on that. They're like,
I don't know if any of them are millionaires, though.
Yeah, we'll make the millionaires, the people out of touch. Hiroshi Tanahashi, Yuya Uemura is our headlining attraction, a rematch from Dominion, which was won by Tanahashi, leaving Uemura devastated. And Uemura, the big focus of Tanahashi, you knew what it was going to be, the dreaded knee that he would center so much of his offense on regarding Uemura. And Uemura applies a Kimura very early on. And I want your opinion. What would you go with? The Yuya Kimura or the Uemura Kimura?
Kuemura? Can we do that?
The Yui Kimura?
Kimura-ora?
I just feel that there's a great opening here for this guy to incorporate a Kimura regularly and come up with something clever to my liking and no one else's.
Yeah. Uemura? No. Okay. I can't. No.
The Kimura it is for now. Tanahashi goes to the dragon screw, and Uemura tries for the deadbolt, and he finally gets him over, but he can't maintain the bridge due to his damaged knee. Really nice spot here. Tanahashi, with his various sling blades, goes to the top for aces high, but then misses the high fly flow. So Uemura climbs, hits his own high fly flow, and Tanahashi kicks out. They've got the crowd at this point. Then Tanahashi, who goes back to the top. My theory at this point, Wei, and you feel free to disagree, I feel like the hop over the top of Tanahashi, I think he's deliberately skimming the top of it to make it look like that much more of a struggle. Am I giving too much credit to Tanahashi here? Because he always now, like, it happens every time that I almost feel this guy is thinking at that level that I should not be able to have that spring in my step. That's not who I am anymore. I should be conveying the breakdown of my body. That's a big part of my story. Now, maybe I'm giving too much credit, but I think Tanahashi would be one of those few performers that I do believe would think to that level. And he always does it. It always looks like he's barely getting over the top.
I imagine it's probably a bit of both, John. Like, I mean, maybe his body is just not capable of doing that. And also probably he realizes that it helps whatever with the current character that he's trying to sell. How far are we extending this? Do you think he's limping on those sling blade charges on purpose?
I'm sure he gets backstage after every show and does a standing moonsault as he gets back. Got him.
Yeah, it was just like on his days off, he's just running like half marathons.
Yeah, that Forbidden Door show in Toronto, he's like, suckers, they're all varying my match. So so we continue on here, and we see Tanahashi with a sit-out drop kick to the knee, back to the dragon screw, and then Uemura sits down, and he hooks. Oh, so they go to this spot where it's Uemura executing a Frankensteiner and immediately transitions to the armbar with Tanahashi bridging on top. And this is how he beat him at Dominion. And it's not like this near fall got like a big reaction from the crowd, but it was a total playoff of how he lost to Tanahashi in June. And Uemura ends with an enziguri, and they just have this struggle with with Uemura battling to get the overhooks and finally overpowers Tanahashi to execute the deadbolt in 18 minutes and 40 seconds, getting the win over Tanahashi in, I thought, like a really strong main event. And I think this is like the best you can expect out of Tanahashi. And I found it to be a really compelling match. And for people that were kind of sour on Uemura losing in June, I thought like this was the bigger win. And afterwards, he addressed Tanahashi. We didn't get the translation of what exactly he said, but I'm sure he was saying, "Tana, I know your knee is just absolutely fine, but I appreciate the selling and what you mean to New Japan Pro Wrestling. Now let's talk about those 10 rules that you were going to institute."
Maybe he was asking him for a raise. Just
that ring. Too. Yes. Yes. Can we talk about unions?
Yeah. Great match, I thought. Similar to coming off the last match, I mean, there is a real running theme in this G1 about like your new generation versus older generation. And I thought that was even maybe more evident in this match because you have a, like almost like a one-to-one direct comparison here between like an old model of Hiroshi Tanahashi and a new model of Hiroshi Tanahashi. And I thought they managed to create like a really great struggle for this sort of passing of the torch where Yuya had to really fight to grab it and Tana was doing everything he could to hold on. My favorite moment was to exemplify that was probably the battle of the high fly flows where Tanahashi missed his. Uemura immediately landed his own, but Tana with that kick out, it was almost as if to say like, it's still my move for a few more months. All right, buddy, it's still my spot. You're not taking it quite yet. I also loved like the slick dragon screw counter from Uemura where he just simply sat down to pin to totally cut off Tanahashi's momentum. Again, Tanahashi has really impressed me in this G1. The body is broken, but like the spirit is still shining through. And I think this deep into the G1, to me, it doesn't appear like Tanahashi is taking it easy at all. He's pushing his body to the limit. And it's making him very compelling to watch. So XL regular for this one.
I go XL with the milk and sugar on this one. I thought it was maybe my favorite Tanahashi match of the G1 so far. Like it was a very strong main event. And to get an 18-minute main event out of Tanahashi in this stage of his career, I think is a big accomplishment. And halfway through, I would say he has over-exceeded my expectations. So ended the show on a very strong note. And I would say the last two matches were recommendations on my part. So,
yep, similar.
At the end of nine nights of the G1, the A block is led by Yota Tsuji, Yuya Uemura, and Evil with 8 points, followed by Ryohei Oiwa, Callum Newman, Taichi, and Oleg Bolton with 6 points, while Tanahashi, Sonata, and Finley are at 4 points, and everyone alive in the block. B block, we have Yoshihashi, Drilla Maloney, Ren Narita, and Great Okan tied with 8 points each, followed by Zack Sabre Jr., Konosuke Takeshita, and Shota Umino with 6, Takagi and El Fantasmo at 4, and Gabe Kidd knocked out of the tournament with nothing.
So top three clinch.
Top three clinch. The top finishers in each get byes to the semifinals. Gotcha. So we will now be, as the shows progress over this next week, we're going to start to be getting to we're going to start to get into the eliminations and then various scenarios. But at this point, it's still pretty wide open in most of these blocks. Like typically, I would assume we're going to get quite the fall for some of these people, such as Yoshihashi and such. But yes.
Yeah,
we get into the more interesting part and where math becomes part of the equation.
Yeah, a less emphasized maybe side story as it relates to Hiroshi Tanahashi is that he's hunting for his 100th G1 victory. He's currently at 99, so that elusive.
I think he's going to lose the rest of his matches, but get 100. I think that's going to be his prize. He doesn't get into the playoffs, but he gets one more win, and that will be his token of victory in this G1.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be a very compelling way to end a G1 career for him, if that is the case. Shall we go through some of our contest standings here?
Wei, tell us how the C block is forming, well, okay? As you just flex those G1 biceps.
I never thought you would ask, John. Thank you very much. And of course, thank you, Chris Engler, who has been hard at work running all of our contests and this particular G1 providing an update after every single event for you at postwrestling.com/G1. First of all, I want to give a shout out to the Daily Perfect Club. On night 8, nobody got a perfect card. So do better, everybody. But on night 9, we had several people do really well. Okay, Daily Perfect Club for night 9 goes to James from SoCal, Mondo Curry, Sean from Edinburgh, and Walter.
Oh, Gunther.
Under his old name, entering our G1 pool. Nice of him to do that. In the overall post wrestling, well, you know what? I think I should start with the C block. Okay,
do it.
C block family standings. I think we're going to start from the bottom. That's how I like to do things. Okay, at the very bottom. I'm so sorry, John Clanchester. You are at 19 points, where you only scored 1 point today.
Halfway through.
You know, he's making the David Finley.
Not out yet.
Davey Portman follows the second to last at 23 points. He's followed by Bruce Lord. As we climb up the ranks here, we've got a tie for, I guess, fourth last with Brandon from New Jersey, Kate from Montreal, and Eric Marcotte. Randobot is beating all of them. So AI.
Not too great of a day for Randobot today.
Going 0 for 5. You're right.
Take that, AI.
But Randobot is doing about the same as Braden Harrington. So, whatever. Good for you, Braden, for doing as well as the AI. Doing better than AI is Neil Flanagan at 28 points. And then tied for fourth place, we've got Brad the Archivist and WH Park, both at 29 points. In third place is the man across from me, John Pollock, with 31 points. So you're not doing too bad yourself, John.
Damn right. I'm coming.
In second place, we have Karen Peterson, the Empress, with 32 points. Very respectable. John Pollock right behind him. So watch out. But all of you, bow to the feet of the king of the summer.
King Ting.
G1 C block leader himself, Wei Ting. 35 points, a whole 3 points ahead of the second placer. Okay. I got 4 points today, 4 out of 5. Beat that. All right. It's over.
Who's going to hold up stronger during this final stretch? Wei Ting or Yoshihashi? That's what we're going to find out. Okay. Is he a contender or a pretender? We're going to find out, because Wei Ting, he's not just beating us by a point or two. He's up on me by a solid 4 and ahead of Karen by 3 points. I mean, the guy is, he is creating a bit of a distance, okay? He might be the Max Verstappen of the C block, but we will see. We will see what we can do in the second half of the G1.
More of the Oscar Piastri for this.
I guess to
year,
be more current, you're right.
Thank you. Yeah, very rare that I would ever lead a C block. But anyway, in our full contest standings, we have James TD standing at the very top with 36 points, but I am actually very close.
Damn.
Tied for second place in the overall
standings.
Wei's
coming for the whole damn thing. He's not winning the C block. He's going to own the block.
A block, B block, I'm coming for you guys, because I'm tied with James from SoCal in second place with 35. Can I win a free year of the Post Wrestling Cafe? Am I allowed
you can
to
have
award
2 years.
Myself that?
2 years. I'll comp the second year as well. Okay.
Okay.
Look out. Look out, C block. Look out, whole block. Look out, Jenny. Wei's coming for every block, okay?
That's right, J-Lo. Watch out. Sean from Edinburgh, Wolfranger, tied for third place with 34 points. They're followed by Caleb B., JC Kazama, Matt Wyatt, Mondo Curry, all tied in fourth place with 33 points. So for our complete listings, of course, go to postwrestling.com/G1. And thank you, Chris Angler, for continuing to give me this confidence boost every morning.
This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, we're going back to November of 1995 as Rewind Away takes a look at the Survivor Series featuring Diesel defending the WWF Championship against Bret Hart. We'll also have weekly editions of Collision Course with the carousel of co-hosts joining Kate from Montreal, reviews of TNA Victory Road, New Japan's Destruction in Kobe, and it is the Ask Away Mailbag Show as John and Wei answer your questions all this month at postwrestlingcafe.com.
Final things before we wrap up. So they're back Saturday with a B-block show. That will include Zack Sabre Jr. against Great O'Khan, Drilla Maloney and Konosuke Takeshita, El Phantasmo against Shingo Takagi, Shota Umino versus Yoshihashi, and then Sunday's show will be headlined by Tanahashi and Yota Tsuji, which I see as another Tanahashi loss. WH Park and Eric Marcotte, they will be back on Sunday with our next G1 show, and Wei and I will be getting together for the August 16th show on the penultimate G1 show before the finals. So that's when you will hear us next doing G1. But before that, You're going to hear us multiple times this weekend after SummerSlam. We're going to go live Saturday night and Sunday night on the Post Wrestling YouTube channel, live and free. And wait, I guess what are, as we look at the cards for both nights, well, night one, we have Gunther, CM Punk for the World Heavyweight Championship. Judgment Day defending the women's tag titles against Charlotte Flair and Alexa Bliss. Roman Reigns and Jey Uso against Braun Braun. Randy Orton and Jelly against Drew McIntyre and Logan Paul. Tiffany Stratton defending the women's title against Jade Cargill. And Sami Zayn against Karrion Kross. Let's just start off with night number one. We know that it is ending with Gunther and CM Punk. And what are the highlights you're looking at for night one? What are the most interesting aspects of the show?
Whether or not there's a cash in, I think that's probably the biggest question here. That is probably what is going to dominate at least a lot of the expectation for the main event and a lot of the conversation heading into the main event. I personally, at this point, don't really expect it, just maybe given the fact that it's so expected. And I think if any of the stuff has been done, it's to create a bit of a shocking surprise. So question is, if Punk beats Gunther,
I would just stick to the plan, because I think that you would, like, as much as it's I think become more apparent about the Seth Rollins deal, I think it is still like going to get a massive reaction, and it's a larger plan that you know, that this whole injury with Seth was designed to elicit for people. So I think that you are looking at, this is the big show that you want to kick off, like a major angle like that. And I would be, can't say it's something where they might just feel like too many people know, but I think that's really playing to the minority and mortgaging your own kind of plans that you had laid out. Like, some know, but it's, to me, not a big deal to still go ahead with something like that. If you are doing this, is the obvious play that it would be on Punk, that the cash-in would occur on? Like, it does not feel like Gunther would be in that position.
I mean, listen, it's Rollins, so it could always be a three-way, and he ends up pinning Punk. That way, you can still get the belt on Seth without having Gunther actually take a loss.
Also prevents Punk from actually winning the title, even for a minute, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I maybe see that if they're going to do that. It would be quite the way to end the first night main event, and would progress into a further feud with either men. So that's probably the most interesting thing coming off of it. I'm curious to see what this Jelly Roll, Logan Paul, Drew McIntyre, Randy Orton thing is. By the way, Drew McIntyre is in the U.S., so that match is not in doubt.
I think the expectation is it's pretty high now for these celebrity crossovers, that I think with Jelly Roll, he's obviously taken this very seriously, and he is training, and there's going to be, like, certainly it will be an audience that will be, I think, very positive for a Jelly Roll. But you do have to do some things to stand out in all of this. So we'll probably get, like, maybe one more angle with them on Friday night on SmackDown going into the show. Reigns and Jey Uso against Braun Breaker and Bronson Reed. I mean, I wasn't on the show Monday night, but I thought that closing angle was terrific that they did in terms of Breaker and Bronson Reed. Like, it wasn't just Braun Breaker that got, you know, the significant portions of that angle, but Bronson Reed. And whether it was just laid out as such or it was just improv, the taking of the shoes, I just thought was, like, if that was a guy, pardon the pun, thinking on his feet, I just thought that was the funniest thing in the world, that he took the guy's shoes and held them up as the closing shot going into SummerSlam. And I feel that ultimately, I think you can get out of this a lot of ways. Like, I feel like this is going to be, like, these four are going to be tied together coming out of this, especially Roman, who I think has singles matches with both of these guys coming out of it. And when Rollins is back, like, I think this is going to be who Reigns is attached to. And I think that angle on Monday was pretty indicative of him trying to get these guys up to that level that the audience is starting to see them in.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's funny how, like, you could do, like, I don't know, a bunch of table spots. You could do, like, the, you know, the craziest spear, but, like, the thing that people will be remembering the most coming off of your angle is guy taking somebody's shoes. So the question of where the shoes are and
why am I doing all these tsunamis? I mean, this is way better.
Yeah, whether or not Bronson Reed attempts to put them on his feet, or if he simply has them, if he wears them on his hands, like there's some sort of like trophy. I'm most curious, perhaps, to see what the result of that
Jordan's
is.
Jordan's on a pole. I think that's where we're going toward.
But the interaction between Reigns and Breaker is going to be pretty electric. You know, that is like maybe a bit of a meeting that they currently have of current and future top act. You know, that's almost like a WrestleMania level match in the making. Curious to see, like, again, if there's a Rollins comeback, how Reigns will figure into it. And I can expect this one doing decently. Like, I say that because I'm always hesitant, you know, with like a Reigns style match. You never really know if you're going to get like a great one or if it's going to be maybe a bit on the slower end. But with Breaker being on the other side, maybe it'll probably be a bit more.
I think the crowd's going to be pretty hot for this one. I think they're going to, especially with like, you know, all the big time offense that you're going to have. And quite honestly, like the typical formula for these WWE shows is that you put the number one match main event and the second biggest match is usually the opener. Like I could certainly see that where this crowd's going to be red hot by the time this show starts and you could get it off to a huge start with these four. So I'm not too worried about that aspect of things.
Yeah.
And I think Breaker doing like one of his just some crazy sequence that's going to get a lot of attention as well. And certainly you could have Jay eat the fall here. You could have think like the heels like need this more because I feel there's going to be the inevitable singles matches to follow.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I also kind of feel like Roman and Jay could always use that win. You know, you shouldn't just have them.
And he takes back the sneakers at the end.
Yeah, yeah. Forget the Ula Fala. It's the
shoes are in the briefcase that Paul is holding.
Yeah, somebody said Shula Fala. I heard, God, which is great. Hey, they all share finishers here, or at least like each person kind of. So you got Jay doing the splash, you got Bronson Reed doing the splash, and you have Roman and Braun doing spears. So maybe
Ryohei Oiwa makes a run in.
Maybe a Gene Blaster in there as well.
Last one on night one, Tiffany Stratton and Jade Cargill. Do you see the title switch here, or do you think they just keep going with Tiffany?
I think. Yeah, because that Naomi was supposed to be a big part of this equation, wasn't it? And she's already off the board. So do we get a title switch? I just don't know if Cargill is ready to lead the division. I think maybe someday she could get there, but I just don't see it in her in-ring abilities to be able to live up to what I would say is a pretty high standard, you know, for in-ring performance.
Kind of feels like it'd be a title switch for the sake of one. And I'm, you know, I could see Tiffany having a much lengthier run with this.
Yeah. So my feeling is no title change. Quality of a match. Do you have any prediction?
I think it's one that's going to be very heavily focused upon. I mean, when you had, you know, this is Tiffany's first big match since, you know, she had the Trish match at Evolution, but prior to that, the Charlotte program at Mania, like this is definitely one where all eyes are going to be on Jade, like rightly or wrongly. I think that's going to be everyone's focus on this match.
A lot of pressure on her. A lot of pressure on them both, but especially Jade.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And I don't think this is going to be a short, well, by longer match, I'm assuming this one gets like 12 minutes at least. Like it's going to be, you know, on a 5-match or 6-match card for the night. I do see this one having time. So yeah, that's going to be more the story of this match rather than who goes over is how the performance comes across. And if, you know, if Jade comes out and looks great in this, I think that's really going to up her stock among many.
I really wish they gave these two a bit more support in terms of like build for this one, because going in, you really don't have much of a story. It's Jade.
This
Cargill
one is definitely suffering from. Yeah.
There's no real heat, no real grudge between the two of them. I would personally, even the both of them going in as double baby faces, I would have liked to have seen more of a conversation about this match being for the person to kind of usher in like a new era of the women's division, for instance, you know? And we don't really have much of that conversation. So that potentially could hurt it in terms of crowd reaction.
Night number two has the rematch from WrestleMania between.
Did we also mention the Zayn and Judgment Day matches?
Yeah, I don't have much on Zayn and Cross to share. I mean, it is worth noting, like Karrion Kross's contract status very much looks to be up in the air, and that could very much influence where this one goes of whether Kross actually resigns or not. And if he's not sticking around, then I think Zane just vanquishes him.
I guess it is largely dependent on that, isn't it? But I guess if he signs, then it makes a lot more sense for Sami Zayn to lose, because
maybe that should have been the storyline on TV.
Will you sign the contract? Yeah.
Yes.
Maybe Zayn can knock Kross out and then sign on his behalf.
While he's unconscious, contract. That's a binding contract.
But the story has always seemed to indicate more like Zayn, you know, via this Kross feud, turning a bit more heel, or at least showing a bit more aggressive edge to his character. And without it, like with Zayn just winning and proving to Kross that he doesn't need to turn heel, I suppose that is worthwhile as well. I just feel like there's a lot more story to be told with Zayn showing a different edge to him.
Yeah. I mean, this one certainly, it's unlike the last match we just talked about with Stratton and Jade. This one has had months of backstory, but I still don't feel this is really crossed over from a TV program to something bigger at this point. But, you know, for Kross, I mean, he's, you know, it's a rare pay-per-view appearance for him, and he's got a great opponent to at least go out and have like a big performance for him. But this one might be kind of more indicative of whatever his status is with the company rather than what's the best storyline direction.
Yeah, I haven't been that into like the TV match that these two had, so I'm looking for this one to overperform that one.
All right, let's zip through night two here. The TLC match has the Wyatt Six defending the tag titles against Andrade and Rey Fénix, DIY, Fraxium, Motor City Machine Guns, and the Street Profits. And they've got to be able to top what was a hell of a TLC match back in April after WrestleMania that is probably going to be lost to memory because it was on TV. And I think that is one of the aspects that you do get much more attention being on like a larger, on a pay-per-view setting that just typically people remember that much more. You certainly have the ability to have quite the match here, but you also have a lot of bodies in this match. And this is going to be one.
What is the most teams they've ever had for a TLC?
I think four. I don't think they've ever done six. I think this is the most that they've ever done.
Yeah, it's going to take a lot of people lying down on the outside, unconscious. It's
probably going to be a lot of that, yes.
But like they will rehearse this to a pretty good degree to make sure that it's compelling. They always
like Nathan Frazier in a TLC match. I mean, just Rey Fénix. Crazy. I mean, there's just so much talent in this match that you know, they're certainly in a position where this one, if laid out effectively, like they could hit the April level, which I just thought was an unbelievable match, and Montez Ford was a big portion of that. This one certainly could be a show stealer.
I'm willing to bet that they will hit that level, just, you know, given like the amount of talent that's there, the setting. Now they won't have as much time to do the match, but
in 4 hours they should have time. That's more than
you need a lot
of
time.
Layout of, yeah, we gotta
need
have
time for Wingstop, Freedom, Minute Maid. Okay, we have a lot of ads to go through. So,
what if RFK Jr. makes a run in during this match?
Will we get the Wingstop ladder?
Oh boy, yeah, that's a great call.
Or maybe like a Wingstop set of wings.
We're gonna get the Slim Jim tables for
yes,
sure.
Yes, true. Will we have a Minute Maid set of chairs?
They might have a minute in between spots here to have to get in all this infomercials.
I'm looking forward to it. Should be really strong.
Dominic Mysterio, AJ Styles for the Intercontinental title. I don't know. Dominic, they're going very hard with him in AAA. That I don't see him dropping this Intercontinental title. I could see him like just squeezing out this this title and holding on to it.
Yeah, I think Dominic is way more compelling right now. I mean, AJ has making a good run as this sort of comedic guy, but I think Dominic is, there's a lot more upside. Yeah, he just attracts so much attention, and I want to see a lot more of him with this run.
Solo Sikoa, Jacob Fatu, Steel Cage for the United States title. Unless they just do like just totally ignore the steel cage stipulations and we do all these run-ins and such, I think Jacob Fatu just comes out of this with the belt again. Like the way that this, if this were just a straight up singles match, I think you could come up with a lot more creative ways, and they could. But I mean, this is I think they have big plans for Jacob Fatu, and I don't think they're just going to have him lose for no reason here to just keep this Solo Sikoa title reign going.
Yeah. I don't disagree. At the same time, I like, where does Solo go from there? You know, like having just a 1 month reign for the championship, when I think like Fatu, you can even make a case to transition him to the main event scene, like the world title scene coming off of a loss. But how do you do that while still maintaining his credibility, right? So I think I'd pick Solo, honestly. And you know this is going to involve the rest of the MFTs somehow. Jimmy as well, most likely.
Becky Lynch, Lyra Valkyria, no DQ, no countout, last chance match, where it states here, if Lynch wins, Valkyria can no longer challenge for the title as long as Lynch is champion. Because the setup on TV made it sound like she can never challenge for this title again. But it sounds like it is just as long as...
I never took it that way, but...
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, regardless, do you see a title change in this one?
No, I don't. I don't. I think...
You go with Lyra can't challenge her anymore.
Yeah, because I think we've seen this match enough anyway, so let's give it a rest, right? So I think Becky maintains it. Whatever's going on with Bayley... You know, they still have maybe that singles match to do between Bayley and Becky that they could save for another.
Could get involved here.
She could. Yep, she could.
They've teased that on television.
But Becky's your star. You know, I think they've done a great job with Lyra, but I think the division should be revolving around Becky.
Naomi, Rhea Ripley, and Io Sky. Yeah, I think this is. Would you classify this as the number two match on the show?
Yeah, I would. On night two, I would, in terms of star power, in terms of attraction. And I think like they're still very much basing this off of maybe some of the prestige of like the WrestleMania three-way.
That's what this is going to be compared to.
Certainly. So it's up to Naomi, you know, to deliver what Bianca Belair.
Where does this get placed? Does this open the show or does this get put later in the show?
I think I could see opener. Yeah. You could place like, honestly,
TLC should be in the middle somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. This, I could certainly see opening it. It will greatly benefit. It'll set the crowd like on a really good, you know, pace. And we're expecting the world of these three. I mean, a lot of pressure on these three as well.
Yeah. I think it's way too early to take the belt off Naomi. I think she's just started this, but like, I'm just more interested in how well this match performs. Like, you have arguably your best talent in the company at the moment in Io Sky, with Rhea in there. Like, it's going to be super heated, especially like if it's in the opener. Like, I could see this opening the second night for sure. Naomi can certainly just sneak away with the belt. But I'm just more interested. Like, this could be your match of the show. There is that potential.
There's that expectation. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of what it is. Like, you have Naomi in for Bianca Belair, and whether Bianca is present at all on this show as well, because you would think she's just about ready to return and would be put into this mix as well. Mm-hmm. And then Cena and Cody Rhodes for the undisputed WWE Championship in a street fight. And again, we're previewing this before SmackDown tonight, but the impetus of tonight's face-to-face is Cody wanting the old John Cena back. And when he cut that promo, it immediately took me back to the Austin lead up to Invasion, where they wanted him to come out of his heel run for 1 week and then immediately went right back at Invasion, which I think was a mistake on their part. And in this one, like, we will see how hard they go tonight on SmackDown, but I feel that the Cena turn feels like it is coming, and I could very well see even a title change in this.
Interesting. How about
you? Or do you think like you have more mileage in this Cena thing to keep going?
I personally think like with what 4 or 5 months left, I feel like it's almost a little too early to wrap up this John Cena campaign to like threaten the, you know, to retire with the belt. I feel like they'll run it up a little bit closer to the end date. But
they're definitely,
you know,
teasing it with Cody. Like they're in that mode of trying to start the turn for Cena, whether you full out do it here or it's a slower turn. Like, I think like they are moving, I think, in that direction.
Interesting. Yeah. Cause like, I guess with Cody, another question you ask is, okay, if he fails again this time, will they do a third match? You know, will they build up to a third match, and will the audience want to see Cody beat John Cena enough the third time they do it? Or is the time to execute right now? And if Cena does turn Well, there's still probably a lot of interest. You could build to a new story, you know, with him for the last few dates. Sorry, the last few months of this run. I'm curious. You know, I'm very curious. I'm especially curious also about whether or not Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, has any sort of role in this. Is this what step are we in The Rock's plan? You know, because it feels like if there's some
where's the role, Rubik's Cube.
If there's some role for him, it would probably be in the climax or the aftermath of this particular match on a stage as big as SummerSlam.
It's also worth noting, at some point, both Cody and Roman Reigns have to film for Street Fighter as well. So there will be a period, like, and I don't know if filming has begun for Street Fighter or it's about to begin, but that's not too far off in the future as well, that both of those guys will have to have some time off for their roles in those films, which are not just cameos either. So there's also that to contend with two of your big stars.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, with Rowan, we're just kind of used to him being on this part-time schedule, right?
That's
with
true.
Cody, you know, I'm sure they can carve out like a month for him somehow, you know, with these sort of infrequent appearances. But
And it sounds like they'll be gone like weeks, not like months for, you know, those roles as well.
Yeah, I truly don't know if this is the type of movie, like just judging by the casting, that's going to demand like months and months of like script rehearsals or just.
No, but you will need several weeks to do that role. So, I mean, it'll be a little bit of time away.
We didn't really talk so much about Judgment Day, Raquel.
That's right.
Raquel and Roxanne versus Charlotte and Alexa. Any thoughts on that one?
I think you ride with like whatever momentum you want to look at towards Charlotte and Alexa. That I think you have something with these two. I could totally see a title change here. God knows this tag division needs some life into it. And I don't think it's you know, the idea of Judgment Day having all the belts. It's like that's not a necessity. You could go either way on this one, but I certainly don't dismiss Charlotte and Alexa winning this one for sure.
I think Charlotte and Alexa win just to cement this team and this run to make it feel more like an actual thing that I think is gaining a lot of traction. A lot of people really love this new version of Charlotte Flair and this team with Alexa Bliss. So let's see them make it concrete, get some successful title defenses, and then eventually drop it back to Raquel and Roxanne Perez, because I think those two have been doing a great job. And obviously, whenever Liv Morgan is ready to come back, you kind of want them being, you know, dominant and with the titles by then. So that's probably not for a while, though.
And we skip the biggest aspect of either night. What is Cardi B going to do?
Great question. Has she been training at the Performance Center?
We do not know.
Is she even performing? Like, what is her role? What is she, a host? Like, what is this? What's she doing?
Maybe she's going to form a trio with Maxine and Natalia, like the Dungeon Dragons.
She's going to be a part of the Dungeon Dragons. Cardi B, maybe this is when we get the rest of the Hart family showing up. Bruce Hart, Cardi B collaboration. Okay. Bruce and Cardi B doing like a version of WAP.
Well, we are moving on. That is SummerSlam. We're back live. We'll be up Saturday night around 11 p.m. ish on Saturday night. So look out for that. And then Sunday after the show live at youtube.com/postwrestling. Hit the subscribe button. Join us Saturday. Join us Sunday. We'll have a G1 show out on Sunday. Plenty to come on a very packed weekend. Are you ready for it all, Way?
I'm ready. I'm set to go. Yeah, I'm so ready. I'm going to be fully recharged after not watching SmackDown tonight.
Yes, we are not back tonight for SmackDown. We'll speak to you next after night one of SummerSlam. Whether we are talking to everybody, the cafe members, anyone out there that has got this show, we thank you and for waiting, helping to navigate this experimental edition of our show. I'm sorry, Wade.
It's fine. Okay. Bye-bye.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.
This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.